destination unknown. Double-crossed messenger, all alone. Can't get no connection, can't get through. Where are you?
Do you want to play? Because if you do, I'll send you $100. Welcome, everyone. Jim Cielinski here, Outdoor Talk Network. And, of course, I'm laying it on heavy. I'm referring to the new contest we have going. Bass Pro Shops join the show. Send me a picture of a fish or, you know, a game animal you harvested and make it clever. Tell me a story. I'll pick a winner each week and send you a coupon for $100 for, you know, a gift certificate from compliments of Bass Pro Shops. This is going to be great. So, all right, stay with us here. I got another contest. We'll talk about that, too. But Bob Zyback is going to join us again, Dr. Bob Zyback, and I interviewed him 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks ago. I forgot, you know, but he's a specialist in forestry management, ecology, historical ecology, and people and civilization and how North America was settled and so forth and how people acted and what they did. And I'm sorry. I'm enthralled with this topic. This is like very important to me. And I had Bob on and I was just throwing questions at him. We were just all over the place. The interview turned out pretty good, but truthfully, you know, I wasn't satisfied. I didn't really have it in my mind. I didn't have a grip on it and be able to talk about it at cabins and hunting camps and the rest of that stuff. I wanted to speak to him again, and that's what we're going to do. We're going to interview Bob Zyback again, Dr. Bob Zyback, and this time I'm going to try to do it in a little bit more coherent fashion, and let's see if I could get my arms around this one so I could show off at parties and camp and on fishing trips and the rest of it with my vast knowledge of so many things. But don't forget Bumper Dumper. If you go to the site and you can log in there too, and the 20th person that buys a Bumper Dumper is going to get a brand new pair of Nikon binoculars. You know, ATBs, they're beautiful. They're my pick. This is what I use. Now, Nikon ATBs, what a tremendous binocular. Use them all the time in the woods, in the fields, and everything else. And you'll enjoy this. The 20th Bumper Dumper sold. You're a winner. So, all right, let me cut it off. I'll start some music, and we'll go to break. We'll come back, and Dr. Bob Zyback, this is going to be great. The Bass Pro Shop contest. Go to the site. Check that out, too. Hey, we'll be back.
But it was long ago. Jane, it was lovely. She was a queen of my night. There in the darkness with the radio playing low and the secrets that we share.
Every so often a product comes along that makes tremendous sense. Enter the Bumper Dumper, your portable sanitary potty that travels with you wherever you go. It easily attaches to your vehicle hitch receiver or stands alone with a 5-gallon bucket. Never again will you not know what to do when nature says you have to go. It comes with a standard toilet seat and just add the available clip-on toilet paper holder for that at-home feeling. It is ideal for camping, hunting, fishing, scouting, traveling, off-roading, wilderness areas, ranches, farms, and how about this one, tailgating. Go to www.bumperdumper.com and take a look. The ultimate portable toilet is super sanitary and makes a great gift for that outdoor fanatic in your family. Lightweight, easy to store, but it will hold 300 pounds. The Bumper Dumper is a must-have for the traveling family. That's www.bumperdumper.com. Of course, it is made in the USA. Not since the introduction of graphite in fishing rods has a product created the excitement of Temple Fork Outfitters' new line of fly rods. Designed primarily by Lefty Cray, TFO has a fly rod for everyone, regardless of your budget. Choose from the Lefty Cray Finesse series for clear water and delicate presentations, or the smooth and powerful Lefty Cray Signature series, or my personal favorite, the medium-fast Lefty Cray Professional series for great all-around performance. Deer Creek Spey rods and Switch rods are all part of TFO's line. For those who prefer fast-action rods, TFO offers their new TICR X rods and their patent-pending Kevlar sandwiched Axiom rods. Their beautiful Gimtini series of fast-action rods can throw sink tips with speed and accuracy. Go to their website at templeforkflyrods.com and check this out. How about the Lefty Cray Blue Water series for chasing marlin, tuna, and sailfish? Hook me up, please. All TFO rods come with a no-fault lifetime warranty.
Delfrost RVR Seasonal Freeze Protection Fluid is a ready-to-use solution that provides protection against bursting of potable water systems when exposed to freezing temperatures. It also contains proprietary corrosion inhibitors to help prevent rusting and corrosion of plumbing system components in seasonal equipment. Products like Dalfrost RVR are important for use in outdoor applications, especially when there's a possibility of drinking water contamination or a chance the product could be spilled near a lake or river. Made from plant-derived biorenewable resources, Dalfrost RVR is readily biodegradable and will break down if spilled on the ground or in the water without harming fish, reptiles, or mammals. It's also safe for use where accidental exposure to children or pets could occur. Dalfrost RVR Seasonal Freeze Protection is available now at Walmart, AutoZone, and other select retailers. For more information, visit www.dalfrostrvr.com. That's dalfrostrvr.com.
All right, we have returned, and Dr. Bob Zybak is one of those gentlemen that I just came to like instantly. We did a show together a couple of 3 weeks ago, and we talked about forestry and all kinds of great things, but we didn't scratch the surface. And Bob, thanks very much for your time, and welcome back to the show.
Thanks a lot. It was an enjoyable interview.
No, it was a good interview. It was a good interview. This stuff fascinates me. I've been loading up. I've had some additional guests talking about this stuff. This whole, you know, forest management, fire management, you know, how people interface with the forest, the whole ecological development thing, Bob, just really fascinates me. It comes up in hunting and fishing conversations all the time. But go ahead, do some setup for us. Remind everyone of your background, what you've done before, what you're doing now, and take it away, Bob.
Okay, well, I'm a fifth or sixth generation Oregonian, so on the west Pacific Northwest here. My background's in forestry and reforestation. I ran a business that did about 80,000 acres of reforestation work. Then the industry kind of fell apart, related a lot in towards the wildlife habitat and spotted owl, so I went back to school and got my PhD in the study of Indian burning patterns and catastrophic wildfire history for Western Oregon. And during that time, became academically familiar with a lot of the things that I believe to be true. And I think one of the key things in those studies is that the idea that wildlife habitat and forest management are not passive occupations. You don't let brush grow up over streams or let beetles invade, and you don't let fires burn, because what's going to happen is a degraded environment that's harmful to wildlife, that destroys habitat, that creates pollution, that a lot of the policies that have been guiding Forest Service and Bureau of Land Management actions, which are a huge problem here in the West.
Mm-hmm.
We're mostly owned by the federal government in Oregon, land-wise, and 80% of our resources. So it affects all of the rural communities as well as the wildlife populations. So
right, right. Well,
I think that's the key finding of my research and the key finding of my presentations is that humans are the keystone species for the past 10,000 years, and human actions have to be considered when we manage a wildlife, when we manage wildlife habitat.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good stuff. Good stuff. I mean, lots of thoughts are coming to my mind, but let me take a whack at the government here for a moment, because it seems like if the federal government owns a lot of land in your state, if it's, you know, 50%, 60%, 80%, you're almost doomed to, the state is almost doomed to poverty, Bob. I hate to say that, but, you know, just one regulation after another, and you can't grow anywhere. You can't expand. You know, the government land has you all boxed in, and, you know, this seems to be a pattern across the West.
Yes, and I think doomed to poverty. I think the record's clear. We've been subjected to poverty in the rural areas We're one of five states over 50% federally owned. It is a Western problem. We're not only bothered with wildfires hitting our communities. L.A. is the famous example most recently, but we've got examples in Oregon and Washington and Idaho as well. But the rural communities have become impoverished. Ranching families, logging families have been devastated by policies of the last 20 or 30 years, whereas for the time following World War II up until 20 or 30 years ago, federal ownership was very responsible. It worked in collaboration with local industries, and our rural counties had significant funding for libraries and roads and public services, and now they're dependent upon asking Congress essentially for welfare payments
right.
every year in lieu of income from federal lands and resources, which are not taxed.
Right.
It's not like the East where all the land produces tax revenue every year and the counties can depend on it. These lands are not taxed, and when they're not producing jobs and when they're producing soil and air pollution as well, they doom us
okay.
to poverty and other problems.
Now, you're a voice of sanity, but let me plug your website. Let me tell everyone to go to www.orww.org. And also, NWMAPSCompany.com, NWMAPSCO.com. I'm going to start some music, Bob. We just blew through the first segment. We're going to come back. Dr. Bob Zybeck is his name, and as you can hear, he's very candid. Second show we're doing together. He is just a wealth of information. Please stay with us. The nation's leading custom rifle manufacturer is without question Jarrett Rifles in Jackson, South Carolina. For 25 years, Kenny Jarrett has been producing the most accurate hunting rifles any man's money can buy. Jarrett manufactures the barrel, the action, and the stock. Jarrett Rifles are guaranteed to shoot 1/2 minute of angle groups. Wow. And Jarrett Rifles owns and operates Cowden Plantation, the South's premier deer hunting location. Check them out on the web at JarrettRifles.com. You will be impressed. Hi, folks. Let me tell you a short story. Mr. Jake Hartwick, one of the founders of the Outdoor Channel, is producing hunting videos. I recently reviewed his first DVD and declared it is destined to revolutionize how hunting films are produced. I actually got a sense of being on the hunt. Yes, folks, it's that good, and it's filmed entirely in high definition, so the video quality is amazing. Get your copy today at www.songofafricasafari.com. That's songofafricasafari.com. The Friends of the Nevada Deer Herd is a new national organization dedicated to saving one of the most famous mule deer herds in the nation. Yes, it is a critical time for mule deer in Nevada. They are rapidly disappearing with each passing year, and so is the grand tradition of mule deer hunting. This trend can be reversed, but only if you are willing to help. Nevada Department of Wildlife has all but written mule deer off and is strategically replacing native mule deer with non-native elk. They must be stopped. Mountain lions are destroying the mule deer resource, and mountain lions must be aggressively controlled. This is an unprecedented fight. Never before has a major western hunting state allowed a native game animal to fade into history while replacing it with a non-native species. Visit Friends of the Nevada Deer Herd at their new home, huntersalert.org, and get involved. Tell Nevada's Department of Wildlife it is time to bring Nevada's mule deer herd back. Starting right now. For the latest in premium deer lures, scents, and calls, go visit moorswidowmaker.com. That's moorswidowmaker.com. There you will find a variety of buck lures, cover scents, and buck calls, all carefully crafted from all natural ingredients. You can also book an exotic hunt on an island in the middle of a river. That's moorswidowmaker.com, moorswidowmaker.com, for the best in deer lures, cover scents, and maybe the hunt of a lifetime. This is Jim Slinsky. So you say to yourself, you like this show with its great guests and great topics. Well, if you're a local business, you really should consider advertising with the Outdoor Talk Network. Just call the local radio station broadcasting this program and ask for their advertising rate. Talk radio is an incredibly powerful communication medium. Advertising on talk radio stations is the best buy in the advertising industry. Talk radio listeners are unique. They listen through the advertising breaks. They don't channel surf and they are loyal. Advertise with a program that local listeners enjoy, and it will certainly benefit your business. When you compare ad rates for talk radio to print media, you will find talk radio a very cost-effective approach to growing your business. If your market is the nation, simply email me at advertising@outdoortalknetwork.com. Lastly, if you cater to outdoor enthusiasts, locally or nationally, it would only make sense to support this program so this program can continue to support you and your business. Dr. Bob Zybach is my guest, Z-Y-B-A-C-H. He's a fourth-generation Oregonian. Correct, Bob? Is that how you say it?
Yep.
Oregonian, not Oregonian, Oregonian.
Yep.
All right. All right. And we're talking about forest and fire and people, and technically, from the most purest sense, he is a historical ecologist is what his main area of expertise is, and he's filling us in. We barely got started. Let me plug his site, ORWW.org, of course, www.ORWW.org, and also you can go to NW Maps Company, NWMAPSCO.com. Of course, put www in front of it again. But, Bob, I'm fascinated. I had you back because you were fascinating the first time. I love this stuff. We have to do a certain amount of rehashing so everyone's up to the same speed, but let's just, and I don't want to blow the whole segment on old stuff, but let's just set a couple parameters down. You know, as far as we know, man was here occupying this land. We're talking about the North American continent, probably right after the last ice age, correct?
Well, at least by that point in time, yes.
Okay, and you know, these were transient people. These are people who are migrating, you know, from Northern Europe and from the Soviet Union or Russia, whatever it's called now, and come across the frozen land masses and frozen waters, and they came down and just penetrated this continent, didn't they?
Yeah, that would be one of the migrations. One thing I think that a lot of people have some confusion on is that they think that there's this frozen land bridge from Asia to North America, but really it wasn't frozen at all. It was ice free and it had thousands of herds of animals, and so hunters could cross that land bridge just very much like crossing the United States today. All along the water, people had boats and could just be fishing and moving along the coastline. So these routes of migration weren't linear by any means. They were major. They were open for thousands of years. And so the migrations of people might not have been so much migrations as much as relocations.
Okay.
Another thing I think that a lot of people don't realize is that, or they don't think about, is that when hunter-gatherers, which essentially the first migrants to the North America travel, they can travel a few thousand miles in a summer or 2 years fairly easily. So moving from one side of a continent to another is not that difficult of an endeavor. And of course, people using boats, there's been good books written just recently by Carl Johansson and others that claim that people were migrating by boats. Thor Heyerdahl made this popular a few decades ago, crossing oceans thousands of years ago. So these migrations were constant. They lasted for long periods of time, and they weren't opportunistic as they're sometimes presented.
All right. So the North America was then connected by land. It wasn't water. They were connected by land. They made the trip by land.
Yeah, and by water, and by coastal rafts or canoes, as well as by transoceanic vessels.
Okay.
There was all kinds of ways into North America, and certainly people were kind of a restless species, and were also able to respond to opportunity. So there's all kinds of ways that people moved across.
Well, that clarifies a lot for me, because I always thought it was you know, frozen in the winter and thawed in the summer, and they had to do this migration over across, you know, these frozen oceans is what they had to do. And then, of course, my next question was, well, how did they survive? Did they pack their food? You know, so what you're saying is, no, it wasn't like that. They used boats, and they went from piece of land to piece of land, and it was connected, and that's how this migration took place.
When you freeze up most of the water in the world in the ice, you create these huge glaciers and so on, but you also open up a lot of land. You can't cover it with snow or rain, and so the land bridge between North America and Asia was hundreds and hundreds of miles wide. It was probably covered with grasses and all kinds of foods, that grazing animals. So people going along the shoreline would eat fish and crabs and clams, and people going overland would eat elephants and deer and elk.
Okay. All right, well, that makes sense.
And rabbits.
That makes sense, because the animals were here before we were, and these people were hunter-gatherers, so they were following herds of animals, and they, as they moved along, they hunted. They were hunter-gatherers. That all makes sense then?
Yep.
All right. I always wondered. I was trying to get some clarification, and this show is as much about, you know, my own edification as anyone else's, Bob. I want to be able to speak about this stuff intelligently, but the animals were here first, and of course the man followed after, and so now we have North America, you know, somewhat populated, or the population growing. Now, when did they come to the realization of land management? When did that take place? Did they you know, try to, you know, did they have to, you know?
I think the land management, that's shown pretty much to be a function of 5 to 10,000 years ago, when people are raising grazing animals and raising vegetables and beginning proto agricultural practices. But the very first people that were here, one of the things that separates us from other animals is that we use fire, and we've used fires for tens of thousands of years. And as soon as you start setting a fire, you're gathering fuel for one, and then the first time an east wind or south wind comes up, whatever a drying wind is in your area of North America, sparks go from those fires, and they catch onto the landscape, and it's probably something that people have known for tens of thousands of years, that if they regularly burn the landscape, they create grasslands. Grasslands increase the populations of large mammals, and it improves hunting for lots of reasons. You can drive animals with fire, of course, but also you can attract animals to glades and other grassy areas, prairies, meadows. And so the very first people that were here began modifying the environment almost immediately through accident and through purpose.
Okay, that all makes sense. Now I don't have enough time for another full question. So let me just do a little plug in here. ORWW.org is the place to go. NW Maps Company, MAPS Company.com. Dr. Bob Zybak is his name. And Bobo, let me start some music. We're going to get into some more details as we come back. It's all coming through loud and clear for me now, okay? You're doing
a great job.
Okay, we'll be back.
You see it all around you. Good love and all bad. And you believe you.
Now, don't touch that dial. You're listening to Jim Slinsky and the Outdoor Talk Network, the most unique talk show in the nation. We'll be right back. This is Jim Slinsky. So you say to yourself, you like this show with its great guests and great topics. Well, if you're a local business, you really should consider advertising with the Outdoor Talk Network. Just call the local radio station broadcasting this program and ask for their advertising rate. Talk radio is an incredibly powerful communication medium. Advertising on talk radio stations is the best buy in the advertising industry. Talk radio listeners are unique. They listen through the advertising breaks. They don't channel surf and they are loyal. Advertise with a program that local listeners enjoy, and it will certainly benefit your business. When you compare ad rates for talk radio to print media, you will find talk radio a very cost-effective approach to growing your business. If your market is the nation, simply email me at advertising@outdoortalknetwork.com. Lastly, if you cater to outdoor enthusiasts, locally or nationally, it would only make sense to support this program so this program can continue to support you and your business. For the latest in premium deer lures, scents, and calls, go visit moorswidowmaker.com. That's M-O-H-R-S, widowmaker.com. There you will find a variety of buck lures, cover scents, and buck calls, all carefully crafted from all natural ingredients. You can also book an exotic hunt on an island in the middle of a river. That's moorswidowmaker.com, M-O-H-R-S, widowmaker.com, for the best in deer lures, cover scents, and maybe the hunt of a lifetime. Hi, folks. Let me tell you a short story. Mr. Jake Hartwick, one of the founders of the Outdoor Channel, is producing hunting videos. I recently reviewed his first DVD and declared it is destined to revolutionize how hunting films are produced. I actually got a sense of being on the hunt. Yes, folks, it's that good, and it's filmed entirely in high definition, so the video quality is amazing. Get your copy today at www.songofafricasafari.com. That's songofafricasafari.com. The nation's leading custom rifle manufacturer is without question Jarrett Rifles in Jackson, South Carolina. For 25 years, Kenny Jarrett has been producing the most accurate hunting rifles any man's money can buy. Jarrett manufactures the barrel, the action, and the stock. Jarrett Rifles are guaranteed to shoot 1/2 minute of angle groups. Wow. And Jarrett Rifles owns and operates Cowden Plantation, the South's premier deer hunting location. Check them out on the web at JarrettRifles.com. You will be impressed. The Friends of the Nevada Deer Herd is a new national organization dedicated to saving one of the most famous mule deer herds in the nation. Yes, it is a critical time for mule deer in Nevada. They are rapidly disappearing with each passing year, and so is the grand tradition of mule deer hunting. This trend can be reversed, but only if you are willing to help. Nevada Department of Wildlife has all but written mule deer off and is strategically replacing native mule deer with non-native elk. They must be stopped. Mountain lions are destroying the mule deer resource, and mountain lions must be aggressively controlled. This is an unprecedented fight. Never before has a major western hunting state allowed a native game animal to fade into history while replacing it with a non-native species. Visit Friends of the Nevada Deer Herd at their new home, huntersalert.org, and get involved. Tell Nevada's Department of Wildlife it is time to bring Nevada's mule deer herd back. Starting right now. All right, Jim Slinsky here, Outdoor Talk Network, doing an interview. Bob Zybach, Dr. Bob Zybach is his name, Z-Y-B-A-C-H, talking about, you know, forest management, people management, fire, this continent, how it was settled and what went on. And he is by trade and a historical ecologist, and I want to plug his sites, nwmapscompany.com, nwmapsco.com, and orww.org is the place to go. And Bob, I'm the pieces are really coming together for me now. This is the second show we're doing it, and I am getting it. But somewhere between 5,000 and 10,000 years ago, you say that we can now see that people are beginning to manage land more actively, rather than I say rather than pure hunter gatherers. Now they're starting to manage land that they've settled on or in their immediate area. Is that true?
I think that's a good way to look at it. They made a strong transition in all areas of the world, including North America, from hunting gathering types of subsistence to more of an agrarian approach.
Okay. Now, let's fast forward to 1492 or 1491 or whatever. And, you know, we always hear stories that when Columbus landed here or wherever he landed and, you know, and so forth, and John Cabot, that the forests were approximately 400 years old. And we hear these stories about, you know, the early settlement here, Jamestown, Plymouth Rock, and the early settlers coming here from Europe. They were looking at a mature hemlock forest, at least on the East Coast, a mature hemlock forest that was 400 years old. How does that tie in? I mean, why wasn't that burned off, or was it burned? Was it burned? Were they continuously burning understory? How does that tie in, Bob?
Well, I'm really familiar with that fantasy that there's a wall-to-wall forest throughout North America, and the technical term I always like to use in reference to that fantasy is that it's mostly just crap.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's really bad because it says that it infers that American Indians were incompetent, inconsequential people, mm-hmm. that they didn't manage their environment. And yet we have places named Buffalo, New York, Savannah, Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
Those are pretty strong clues. The Shenandoah Valley, or we had vast grasslands. We had agriculture all along the Mississippi. I mean, most of the different types of vegetation that people use around the world, not the bulk of the vegetation, but the variety, comes from North and South America. Hundreds of varieties of potatoes from South America, corn, squash, pumpkins. Where these things don't grow in a forest. They don't grow in old growth. And the idea that there's ancient old trees throughout North America is a fabrication.
Okay. It's,
in a way, it's a justification for the way that American Indians were treated by the white immigrants.
All right. Well, you know, along with that story, along with that fantasy that you're referring to, there's another part of that fantasy. And the other part of that fantasy was that in you know, the 1400s, the 1500s, we introduced disease into America, that the population of America was around could have been as high as 100, 110, 120 million Native Americans at the time. But in that 200-year period between, you know, between Columbus and John Cabot and so forth over to Plymouth Rock, in that brief period of time, that, you know, 100 million Native Americans died and everything got out of control, and the land, you know, the burning stopped and everything changed. And, you know, what's your story on that one, Bob? How is that one incorrect?
Well, I don't think that's incorrect. I think that is correct. I think that 100 million people throughout North America is a fairly reasonable estimate. It might even be modest. The record is clear. Diseases that were imported from Africa and Europe by way of sailors decimated local populations, and they did it in a matter of months and years. There's over in the western U.S., we have historical accounts of the effects of disease brought by Hudson's Bay trappers in Northern California, for example, in the late 1820s. And we've got the similar accounts by Lewis and Clark along the Columbia River in the early 1800s, and their records of earlier encounters of smallpox from the 1780s from shipping from people that are trading by ships along the coastline. So the people did not have good biological resistance to these diseases, and populations and civilizations just collapsed.
Okay. Makes sense once again. Now, when those populations collapsed, is it possible that wildlife populations rebounded at that time? Because we hear stories of North America wasn't a mecca for wildlife, that these hunter-gatherers and these thousands of years of settlement and civilizations took their toll on our wildlife populations.
That's exactly right. If you look at archaeological records or you look at other records, with wildlife it's called an eruption, IRRUPTION. And the wildlife just responds dramatically. And for modern examples, people that are familiar with, say, rabbit populations in Australia, where there's no resistance and there's all this opportunity for wildlife numbers to explode. It's exactly what happens. So buffalo, elk, deer, and the predators that feed on those species, or we've got good records of the people die off, and in Western Oregon, I've tracked a lot of those numbers. Charles Kay has done it on a more national basis. The numbers of animals respond within years and decades. So when you're looking at periods of centuries between a dramatic drop in a human population and then the response of wildlife, it's an obvious part of our history.
All right. I had Dr. Kay on a couple times, and he likes to talk about the Lewis and Clark expedition, that when the Lewis and Clark expedition took place, when they did that, they found primarily wildlife was located in pockets, and it was usually at the edge of one tribe's territory where it butted up against the territory of another tribe. This kind of buffer zone where they were careful not to cross the line and go into each other's area is where the highest population densities, wildlife densities, were found. But there were large expanses, you know, during the Lewis and Clark expedition that no wildlife was observed. You know,
that was in 1805 and 1806. And in 1841, another example, the Wilkes expedition, which was a U.S. government military expedition of exploration around the world, but also had good reports or accurate reports from Washington, Pacific Northwest, and Northern California. A group of them, of the Wilkes expedition, including a wildlife biologist, went across eastern Washington to Idaho, where they found Indians raising potatoes that they'd gotten from white immigrants, probably preachers or somebody. But they said there was only one four-legged animal that they saw the whole way from western Washington to Idaho, and that was a coyote.
Huh.
So the idea that that there's vast amounts of wild game, and in the archaeological record, people come and then they eat the available four-legged mammals, and then they go to fish and berries and roots and crops such as that, and you just see a marked decline in mammals. It becomes more of a treat rather than a subsistence type food.
Well, that makes sense. That all ties it together. That's why. But you know, I love this stuff. I love this stuff because of all of I guess you got to say there's a tremendous amount of misinformation about this whole civilization, you know, colonization of the North American continent and how it all came to be. This stuff, Bob is just misquoted continuously.
Yep, it's misrepresented. There's lots of reasons for that. And I think the main reason, I'm a middle-aged white guy, so I'm not being racist here, but I think middle-aged white guys are our main historians, and they're racist and sexist, like lots of populations of people. And so all of our written history, all of it, you go back from Columbus forward for hundreds of years, is written by white males.
Mm-hmm.
And so they misrepresent things to their own advantage, like any group of people or any individual would typically do. But over time, that viewpoint, that perspective, becomes ingrained as the history.
Okay.
And it's really only the history of the perspective of successful white males that are literate.
Okay.
Which is a very small segment of the population, and that's what gives us our distorted view of history more than any other thing.
All right. And, well, of course, that distorted view, people have picked up on that, and especially the environmental movement and a lot of the...
It's been ingrained. They've been force-fed it. It's been taught in our schools. It's part of our policy. It's our history. And so the environmental movement is convenient to their purposes, and they fight it in the courts, and it becomes litigation, and that's another white male industry.
All right. Let me start some music up against the break here. Do something a little bit different. Dr. Bob Zybach is his name, Zybach, and we're talking about the settlement of this continent. Trying to put all the pieces together myself. Please stay with us. We'll be back. For 2009, Nikon Sport Optics continues their passion to bring you the toughest, most innovative optical gear ever. The recently completely redesigned Monarch rifle scopes with their advanced iBox technology, delivering an impressive 4x zoom range and a constant 4 inches of eye relief, has been expanded to include new models. Nikon's Omega 250 BDC bullet drop compensating muzzle loading scopes and their Slug Hunter BDC 200 have become classics, now available in new power ranges. With the new laser rangefinders designed specifically for bow hunting, titanium scopes, handgun scopes, Buckmasters and Pro Staff scopes, 16 different binocular lines, and premium spotting scopes, you can see why Nikon has something for every hunter and every hunting style. And completely new for this year are their Coyote Special rifle scopes in camo with anti-reflective designs and a patent-pending predator hunting reticle. Check out a Nikon rifle scope today and see why experienced hunters choose Nikon. Hunting is no longer just how to and where to. Hunting has become a will it continue situation. NRAHuntersRights.org is the best place to keep up with the escalating threats to hunting and NRA's efforts to combat them. NRA works to increase hunter access on public lands, keep shooting ranges open, recruit new hunters, and defeat the growing tide of animal rights extremists and anti-hunting groups. At NRAHuntersRights.org, you will also find forums to express your opinion on critical hunting issues, a trophy gallery to post photos of your downed game, a state-by-state index of public hunting lands, and a monthly gift giveaway where you might win guns, optics, knives, and other gear. You might even find a column or two by yours truly. NRA, defending your freedom to hunt. Visit www.nrahuntersrights.org and get involved. The future of your right to hunt depends on you. Why join the Hunting Channel? Aside from having all the best shows on TV available to you 24/7 and my radio show anywhere, anytime, receive instant discounts on gear, hunting guides, outfitters, and much, much more. How about access to tips from professional hunters, up-to-date articles, and gear reviews? With just the discounts alone, most members will recoup their membership fee with their first gear purchase or their first hunt. Think about it. Go on a $4,500 elk hunt in Colorado and get a 10% discount with the outfitter. That's $450 saved. Or buy an $800 rifle and scope or bow and save $80. These savings are easily worth $24.95 a year, plus all the other useful information available after becoming a member. Go to their website at www.thehuntingchannelonline.com and join today. If you use promo code OTN, you will get 4 months free. That's promo code OTN and start saving now. Well, I'll admit it, this show was as much about me as it was about anybody else. I wanted to get all this information clear in my head. And, of course, Dr. Bob Zybak, he was on once before. He was just fascinating, and he joined us again. I want you to go to his sites, ORWW.org, ORWW.org, and, of course, NW Maps Company, MAPSCO.com is the place to go. And he's just been terrific. My head is spinning right now, but I am getting it, Bob. I am getting it. It's all coming through loud and clear now. But let me take you back to the use of fire, and because we hear so much about fire, just let it burn and you know, stop it and so forth. Now, is it okay to say, is it reasonable to assume that those settlers that came here after the last ice age, they were already well acquainted with fire, how to use it, and they were probably practicing it from where they came, correct?
Yeah, people at that time undoubtedly were much better users and more knowledgeable about it than we are today. It was just a fact of life. And kids could start a fire within a minute or two, and people understood full well how different types of fuels burnt, how to manage landscape areas landscape scale areas with fire. It had been going on for thousands of years, and they were literally raised in that environment their entire lives. So right. they were experts with fire.
Well, we've been told that fire was used by these early settlers and so forth. Fire was used in two different ways. First, it was used to clear the land. And I guess that's probably a fair assumption to clear the land, started on fire. And the other thing we've heard and we've been told is they cleared the land, or they used the fire to generate habitat so that they didn't have to go as far to hunt. If they burned the land around them, if they had everything in early successional growth in nearby, that they created their own hunting mecca, because wildlife does so well in early successional forests. And these are reasonably accurate, Bob?
Well, you know, the land clearing thing, again, that builds into the mythology. People don't clear land that's already cleared. So we got thousands of generations of people. There wasn't any land to clear.
Okay.
They were raised in grasslands and agricultural lands where they managed a forest and widely spaced large trees. So it wasn't a land clearing device. That's what the very first individual does, and he might do it by accident. You know, just a campfire get out of control, and the land's clear. That's a one-step process. There are three main ways that people used fire that really affected the environment, and need to be better understood as far as our federal policies are concerned. One, they had fire going constantly in campfires, ovens, cooking fires, sweat lodges, and so on. So that meant gathering dead wood, dead materials from the surrounding area, and burning it in a fire pit. And that's got one real major effect. Anybody that's done a lot of elk hunting and gone to the same elk camps every year knows that the first couple of days you gather firewood from around your campfire, then you go further and further, and pretty soon you're in a pickup truck with a chainsaw driving miles to get firewood.
Mm-hmm.
And so you don't have a lot of dead wood, and you don't have a lot of snags in the environment like a lot of the environmentalists want to have. They call it wildlife habitat because insects and animals will occupy dead wood. They assume that that was always part of the environment, but that is assuming, once again, that Indians are inept or inefficient, that they don't know how to gather firewood. So
okay.
Firewood's one. The second one is patch burning, where you burn off a decadent stand of huckleberry or salmonberry or invasive weeds, quite often trees. And that can be done at about any time of year, and people would burn patches of vegetation to get various results. Hazel, for instance, to either roast nuts if they were older hazel, or to create basket weaving sprouts if they were younger. And then the third one is the maintenance fires. Not land clearing, but land maintenance, in which thousands of acres of contiguous grasslands or tarweed or those types of crops were burnt almost every year or every year. To keep the land clear, and to maybe to drive game, maybe to create the browse to attract game, but maybe to just process vegetation. But so those three types of fires, over the course of centuries and millions of acres, create a stable landscape pattern that produces a lot of protein and works as wildlife habitat patterns preceding white immigration.
Okay, and they understood this.
They were experts at it. They didn't not only understood it, they lived it and breathed it, depended on it, and kids were raised in that environment. They didn't have to be taught how to start a fire. They saw it being done every day of their life.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It was second nature, just like we understand, I don't know, walking or tying our shoes or driving a car. It was just a second nature thing.
Here we are 10,000 years later, 15,000 years later, whatever it may be, and all of a sudden, you know, fire is you know, not used as extensively, and yet when it does get started, I mean, we're not even using fire as the management tool at all, and when it does get started, we got a heck of a time dealing with putting it out. I mean, it's just things.
We're inept. Look at L.A. this year. It's crazy. Look at all the dead trees in Southwest Oregon. Just read the newspapers. Look what happened in Australia. Hundreds of people died. We're incompetent with fire, and yet because we know the Latin names of all the chemical components of fire, or we can measure the temperature. We think we're expert with fire, but it's just the opposite. We have got a lot to learn, and we could learn that by studying earlier so-called primitive groups of people.
Okay, and what you're saying is that we've lost our way. We should be using fire as a management tool. Even today, we should still be doing partial burns and this type of thing as an active management tool.
Absolutely. If there's all kinds of good positive modern management objectives that can be attained by using fire in a controlled, intelligent manner. Letting it burn out of control, or waiting for the lightning gods to have ignitions and calling that return of fire to the environment, is just really bad resource management. It's bad fire management, and it just shows a real ignorance about the role of fire in human history. And the fact that a lot of this ignorance has been adopted into federal policy is just almost inexcusable,
yeah,
from my perspective.
Right. It does. When you put all the pieces together, it becomes shocking that we're in the state that we're in.
Shocking is a good word for it.
It's just literally shocking.
Embarrassing is another one.
Yeah, shocking. Well, in the South, they do quite a bit of control burns in the South.
They have
long growing seasons, and the hunters are criticized in a lot of cases. The hunters want to see those control burns, and they want to see that clutter on the forest floor burnt off, and they want to see some regeneration, and they know it's good for wildlife. And we always get pinned that we just want to do this just because we want to shoot more deer, and it's really more complex than that, isn't it?
There's lots of good reasons. You reduce air pollution, you reduce wildfire hazard, you shoot more deer. That's another advantage. You attract more game birds, and you attract more beautiful birds and butterflies as well. The Indians burn for lots and lots of good reasons. In the South, you're lucky in certain ways that most of your land's privately owned, and there's more of a tradition of regular burning of the piney woods and so on in the South. In the Western United States, we've had federal ownership and management of our lands for over a century. We don't have these types of practices ingrained, and so we're more at the mercy of federal policies that are based on really low-grade science, which agency scientists, the government scientists who for years said, that's a person paid by industry, and what we're doing is not biased. And I think it's just the opposite. I think the bias of the agencies and the universities has really misguided a lot of our resource management policies and degraded our environment, our air, and our water a result of that.
Is anyone else fighting this fight and speaking out the way you're speaking out?
Well, they've got probably too good of filters to speak out the way I speak out. Maybe me and Charles Kay are part of a group, small group that voice our opinions. But I think it's just now starting to, after 20 or 30 years of dealing with these issues, I think it's just now starting to gather hold with these fires that we've been having and that were predicted, that these aren't a good part of the environment and something needs to be done. But to a large degree, it's still a very small voice of reason and rationale and common sense that is arguing that the old ways were better.
Okay. Now, the actual act of burning and the ash created from the burn trees and so forth, that stuff is nutritious for the soil, isn't it? I mean, I seem to remember potassium, or maybe they call it potash and so forth. Doesn't that ash actually sweeten the soil?
Oh, sure, yeah. Any time you can add nutrients to the soil, it's good. And so regular burning tends to enrich the soil, and the black earth, what's it called, terra prata, I think in South America, they're just starting to discover really black soils with lots of carbon in it. Amazon that remain from successful earlier cultures. So yeah, that's another advantage.
Okay. All right, you were terrific. Let me plug the sites once again. ORWW.org is the place to go. NWMapsCompany.com, MAPSCO.com, NWMapsCompany.com. Dr. Bob Zybak, you really enlightened me, Bob. Thank you very, very much for your time.
You're welcome. It was a lot of fun.
All right. And let me thank everyone for listening. Once again, dedicate the show to my father, as I always do. God bless him. His hunting and fishing plans always included me. Hey, see you then.